You're the Peer Podcast with Leo Battari, Season 1, Episode 25. Hi, I'm Randy Cantrell. Welcome to the Year of the Peer Podcast with Leo Battari. This podcast is based on a simple truth. Who you surround yourself with matters. Author and keynote speaker Leo Battari will interview thought leaders from all walks of life who will share how they leverage peer advantage and show you how engaging your peers more purposefully can hold the key to greater success in business and in life. Today's guests join us from the Louisiana Department of Public Safety and Corrections. Secretary James LeBlanc has worked for the Louisiana Department of Public Safety and Corrections for more than 40 years, appointed by two governors to serve the past 9 years as secretary. His corrections career began in 1973 at Louisiana Correctional Institute for Women. LeBlanc promoted through the ranks, serving as undersecretary, interim director of probation and parole, warden at Dixon Correctional Institute, and acting chief of operations. Perry Stagg is Deputy Assistant Secretary at the Louisiana Department of Public Safety and Corrections. He oversees the Office of Adult Services and has worked in corrections for 21 years. We welcome James and Perry to the show.
Jimmy LeBlanc and Perry Stagg, welcome to the program today. So appreciative that you're able to join us here. You know, Perry, of course, you and I met just about a year ago, actually, as part of the Warden Exchange Program. There was a meeting in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, that was one of the most extraordinary things I had ever really attended, not only because I saw the prison wardens coming together and really learning from one another, but that, of course, and we'll spend some time a little bit on this later on in the program, but the visit to the Louisiana State Penitentiary, otherwise also known as Angola, prison was one of the most extraordinary experiences I've ever had in terms of a lot of the incredible work you folks are doing there. So if we could start maybe by each of you just introducing yourselves and exactly what your role is at the Department of Corrections, Louisiana, that'd be great.
Okay, I'll crank it up. I'm Jimmy LeBlanc, the Secretary of Public Safety and Corrections, and just a real quick background. I've been in the department for over 40 years and actually grew up in the department and excited about being able to be in this position to make some differences in people's lives. So, you know, there have been a lot of changes in Louisiana over the last several months, in particular, our Louisiana Task Force Reinvestment Group. I'll let Perry kind of introduce himself and we can kind of talk back and forth and then crank up a conversation on kind of where we are and where we think we head.
Oh, that'd be great. Thank you.
My name is Perry Stagg. I have over 20 years experience in the Department of Corrections in multiple fields, from prison industries to security in the prisons to programming and now an administrative position here at headquarters. My current job is a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Adult Services. You know, when you and I met, we got to tour Angola. I know this is one thing that you want. One of the main things you want to talk about is our reentry program we have up there, and that was one of the more fulfilling and rewarding programs I've been involved in since I've been with the Department of Corrections. So.
Well, I think one of the interesting things for me is I had an expectation when I went to the Warden Exchange Program meeting to have the wardens come together and learn from one another. But during the visit to Angola Prison, to be able to see the influence of prisoners and the prisoner-run programs that are there were just so extraordinary that obviously have a lot to do with some of the reentry success that you're having there. But I'd love for you, maybe we can dive right into that. Let's maybe talk about some of the programs at Angola, how they're run, and maybe what some of the highlights are of that you'd like to tell us about.
Well, one thing about the programs that we're running, you mentioned them being inmate-led programs, and what that a lot of people in the prison industry that work in the prison field, field of corrections, hear inmate-led programs and they cringe because it's not something you normally do in prison is let inmates have authority or responsibility over anything you're doing. You want to maintain control. And we do maintain control, but we've identified because of the open-mindedness and the vision of people like Secretary LeBlanc and some of the judges that we work with in this program, they're willing to go out there and do unique things because we think we have the type of inmates to do it with. Because of some programs we have, like we have a seminary in Angola, it's a four-year graduate program, produce some really well-educated and well-rounded individuals out of that program who have good moral character and a good background for counseling, and they have a willingness to give back, they have big hearts. And so we felt like we had the type of inmates to do this with. So what we've done in this program is we have teamed up with different district courts around the state. The judges will sentence an inmate with less than 10 years or less, nonviolent, non-sex offenders, mostly property and drug crimes. They will get sentenced to Angola for at least a minimum of a two-year period. When they get there, the first thing we do is team them up with a mentor who is normally a lifer, an inmate with a life sentence. Mm. In Louisiana, a life sentence usually means a life sentence. There's not many opportunities for getting out. Secretary will address that some more later when we talk about the justice reinvestment and justice reform that we're currently working on. But teaming them up with this guy who we've identified as a staff, we've hand-selected this guy to be a mentor to this individual. So within the 2 years that this inmate is there, he's going to accomplish four things, really. He's going to get his education. He's going to come out with a GED, or what we now call a HISET. He's going to have a vocation. We have very well-run vocational schools. They're going to maintain some sort of nationally or internationally accredited accreditation, recognized accreditation. So he'll be a welder, auto mechanic, you know, air conditioner repair, you know, something like that, something he can go out and get a real job, a career. He's going to go through all his life skills classes, whatever our assessment says that he needs as far as programming goes, whether it's substance abuse, parenting classes, financial management, he's going to get all that. But the fourth part, and really the most important part of this program, is the moral component. The mentor's job is really to provide a good example for this inmate of how he's supposed to live his life. So what we found out is that we can make smarter inmates, we can make more skilled inmates, we can give them all the other treatment we want to give them. But until we change the moral component, then we haven't done anything. We've made a smarter criminal, and that's not what we're in the business of doing. So the moral component is very important, and that's what the inmate mentor's job is in relation to the mentee, is for instilling that moral component in this young man.
Yeah, and it seems too that the flip side of that was there's no question that the moral component, the faith-based aspect of it is a really essential part of it. But then there's also, and maybe Secretary, you may be able to, you know, want to address this also, is that in addition to the moral component, though, you also really give them a sense of purpose. You know, and as opposed to just, all right, I'm in prison for the rest of my life, I'm just going to be angry and just not really, really have much to do in terms of positively put my energy. Now, all of a sudden, you really have given them a purpose that, as a community leader in many respects, which I found really extraordinary among the inmates that I met when I was at Angola.
Yeah, you know, and a couple of things in what Perry talked about that goes back into my experience as a warden at Dixon Correctional Institute. When, and this is more related to the faith-based side than it is anything else, but I was approached by Warden Kane at the time, this has been many years ago, about accepting what we call missionaries at DCI, and you know, that were graduating from the Bible College, had some experience, and you know, the first thing I thought of, and for lack of a better term, is shade tree religions, and I'm going to have a group here, and they'll start isolating themselves and worry about gang activity. And I was totally, totally wrong. And because Burl and I were good friends at the time and still are, that I went ahead and took that opportunity or change and went with it. And it was the best decision I ever made as a warden. It was amazing at the inmate-on-inmate assaults, contraband issues, all that just kind of dropped off the charts. With these two guys actually ended up with their own ID where they could move around the prison and be where they needed to be in case of a death or an accident. They helped the chaplains. Just a great experience. And that certainly brought me into this process that we're into today. It's graduated into what we call a reentry court program. And in relation to the moral side is the soft skills. You know, in that sense that, you know, and when I first got into corrections organized for reentry as actually piloting it for the department at Dixon, I understood that one of our major contractors in South Louisiana decided he wasn't going to hire any more ex-offenders. And I thought, well, what's the issue here? So I took the time out, went down and made had a meeting with Mr. Bo of Bo Brothers. And the first thing he said, Secretary LeBlanc, he said, Ward LeBlanc at the time, I don't care how good of skills they have. If they're going to give me a problem on the job, then I don't need them. And so that taught me a lesson there that we have a lot more to do with soft skills and helping our employers understand that, because they all come from a different environment. And what you're just saying, this is the first opportunity most of these people have had for an opportunity to change. And I'm a firm believer in second chances. And these people have never had that second chance. And given that opportunity, we see the positive things going on here that's good. You know, the downside, not downside, but the challenge here is the numbers. We discharge 17,000 a year, whereas we have probably 200 in that neighborhood that are participating in this program. And so we have got to be able to expand that. And it's getting national recognition, and it deserves national recognition for what's happening. And Perry has been very instrumental in getting that program off the ground to where it is today. And we're real proud of it and excited about the opportunities down the road of what we can do on the expansion side, especially as we talk maybe about some of the reinvestment part of the package that we are going to have here over the next several years.
Yeah, it is fascinating. First of all, I was actually just at one of the recent Warden Exchange meetings in Houston, and Burl Cain was there. So he was kind enough to, because we had met first time in Baton Rouge, and he was kind enough to come up and say hello, and we chatted for a little bit. And I think what I also found amazing was some of the other wardens were so impressed with what you were doing. And I think there were two aspects of it too, that if I recall this correctly, that surprised them and were a bit different. And again, I think speak to the progressive nature of what you're doing there in the state. One is that this mentor relationship you're talking about often continues after the inmate is released, correct? Where there's very unusual, the idea that there would be, contact in that regard, correct? And how is that? How do you find that?
Give you a quick little story about that. In fact, this past weekend, this past Saturday, one of our judges bought 300 pounds of shrimp, went to Angola, and with his own money, and did a mentor appreciation dinner. And
wow,
30 of the program graduates actually went back and had lunch with the mentors. And so, yeah, they maintain that relationship. It's a very strong bond. And it's a positive bond. That's the most important part.
And the other thing, too, if I recall, and if I have this correct, let's say if, I'm an inmate that's participating in the automotive program, for example, right? And, I get to a place where I am deemed also by my other inmates as kind of ready, on the outside. Isn't it correct that there is some peer or prisoner, say or involvement, if you will, in terms of whether the person is ready to be released?
Yeah, we count on the mentors to do monthly progress reports, and they get verbal feedback constantly with the staff, with the administration and the staff who run the program. The inmate has no authority, the mentor has no authority over whether the offender participating in the program goes home. But he does have he has a tremendous responsibility to report accurate information. And so we use their feedback in a tremendous way when it comes to making a determination of whether this guy's ready to go home. Like we said, there's three things that are static. He either got his vocational skills or he didn't. You know, he either got his GED or he didn't. And he either completed his life skills classes or he didn't. The fourth part, the moral component, is it requires a lot of feedback from the mentor because they spend 24/7 with him. We see him, throughout the day, pieces of the day, but the mentor is with them 24/7. So we do depend a lot on their feedback on that component.
Yeah, I just thought that was extraordinary. Of course, it makes perfect sense. One of the things that I did also was after being introduced during my visit to several of the programs there, of course, you all talked about the documentary Serving Life that was produced, I believe, in 2011. That, of course, the title in and of itself, of course, not only speaks to the sentence, but speaks to prisoners serving one another in hospice care. And I thought It was one of the most extraordinarily moving documentaries I've ever seen. It was just really remarkable. But you may want to talk about maybe some of the breadth of some of these programs, because my understanding, at least in Angola, and of course there may be other programs, of course, throughout the state, there were about a dozen programs there, as I recall. Is that about right?
There's many programs. Yeah,
there's an awful lot of programs. A dozen, maybe not quite where we are. We have an awful lot, but you're right about the hospice and the way that works. It's if that documentary didn't bring a tear to your eye, you don't have any emotions. It was a tough situation, and of course we see that day in and day out, being in a situation we're in with almost 5,000 lifers that they're lifers in Louisiana. When you're a lifer, you don't see the light of day, and all you have to do is walk through our infirmaries and look at the hospital and see what we have, and 90% of those are lifers. And so that in itself is a challenge. But, you know, reentry programs is where we are. And like, I can't say enough about the mentors. I mean, most of them are lifers, and they have changed their life. They have rehabilitated themselves. And I'm a firm believer in our task force. We had that on the table and we talked about it, had good dialogue about changing our way of doing things in that regard, and we made some progress. And I'll just say real quickly that there were a group of individuals that are doing life sentences now that when they were convicted, they had life with parole. That got changed, and it was an ex post facto thing. And so the DAs and the sheriffs were willing to look at that 160 group. So we have right now roughly 160 lifers, mostly at Angola and Hunt, that are going to be eligible for parole. And again, eligible for parole, not necessarily getting out, but eligible for parole. To me, that's the little crack in the door, get us started on ways to look at that, of getting these lifers another opportunity. And look, the victims have to be involved, and we understand that. I'm probably getting off a little bit here that we don't need to be getting off into, but we know the victims need to be involved in this process. We have another, and this is a program, Victim Offender Dialogue, which is real important. You have to volunteer as a victim, but we know that's successful. Once a victim determines, yeah, I want to meet the inmate, and they have that conversation, and there's forgiveness in that. When that victim can learn to forgive, it's a relief for them. And that's important to note. And so as we move forward with this LIFER situation in Louisiana, look, you can look at Texas, Oklahoma, and Mississippi. You can look at their life without parole, and it's minuscule compared to where we are. I mean, or such an outlier for life without parole, it's scary. And so there needs to be some change there, and we haven't given up on that. That's something that we'll be working on over the next year or so. But we have, you know, we have vocational programs, as Perry alluded to. We have reentry programs. We have the Bible College. We just have a multitude of things that are going on in Angola. You know, the most impressive thing for me is when you tour up there and you bring another warden or a director from another state in there, and they walk through and said, my God, you know what, you know, how do you get the calmness that you have there? It's a unique environment that has been developed over time. And I think it's because of the opportunities. I think the opportunities for a lifer to go through a Bible college, to be able to provide some give back to the community and to these offenders that are coming in that are young, to have that impression on them that, hey, you don't want to make the same mistake that I made. You need to change your life. That to me is what it's all about. And look, we've had some significant budget problems that, you know, we have in some cases one female correction officer with 170 inmates in the evening time at Angola. Unheard of. And we want to improve on that a little bit, but you know, that's where we are at Angola right now. And thank goodness for the inmates and the staff up there for doing what they do to keep Angola where it is today, a very calm facility that creates a lot of opportunity for people that come into there through the reentry court in particular. We closed the whole prison, Phelps Correctional Center, in West Louisiana, 900-bed facility, this is a facility that people are getting out. We moved that facility to Angola to Camp C. It's Camp C, and we moved that whole group there and gave a little relief with some funding and stuff, but we moved them there for that same purpose that reentry court provides, that they get an opportunity to be trained by mentors, to have an opportunity to be trained, and it's working well. So that's a whole nother group that we have there that actually discharge back to our communities that don't go through the reentry court process.
You know, you hear the secretary talk about the calmness, and you mentioned this earlier, a big part of it is giving these inmates ownership. You know, we give them the program like reentry, and we support it, and we do the administrative part, but it's their program. They're really running the day-to-day operation.
Yeah.
Same hospice. They're running the day-to-day operation of this program, you know, with oversight from the nursing staff. But we give them ownership of these things, and it really makes them, you know, that it feels like it's theirs and it's their community, and they're a big part of it. And that's one reason that we have such good statistics on our, you know, our discipline behavior, that kind of stuff, is because they feel like it's their community and they try to protect it.
I think that this notion of community is really essential. I mean, because first of all, the mentors that I met were incredibly impressive. I mean, these are people, and I don't feel like these are clearly not the same people today as they were when they went in. And these are people that I came back, you know, here in California and just talked about it to people and said, you know, I was with a bunch of these mentors and I'd be perfectly happy that they were living right here in my neighborhood. I mean, they were just impressive individuals who cared about others, who were working and had an incredible sense of purpose, were, I think, proud of what they were doing, and the fact that they are able to make a contribution, I think, was really extraordinary. But, you know, it was just interesting for me to see wardens learning from one another and working together, prisoners doing the same thing, and you know, to an extraordinary end, and that you really are addressing, and this was what so many of the wardens talked about as well, in these kind of side conversations, but was that you weren't addressing just what these people can do or trying to improve skills and all, like you said, but really touching who they are as people. And the extraordinary difference in the value that you're providing there is just amazing. I would love for you to talk about some of what's next. I know you've got some, you know, plans for the future with regard to this notion of reentry. And I think this is really essential for business leaders in particular to realize that, to your point, nonviolent offenders who they serve their time. And I'd like to think that in the U.S., it's not a life sentence, regardless of what the sentence the judge gave. I mean, today, you could argue that it's a life sentence. When you've got to check off the box and you've got to have that, you know, felon brand on you for your life, I think that it would appear to me that you've got business leaders missing out on incredibly you know, competent, good people out there that who deserve a second chance and who can make an extraordinary contribution to society. But I'd love for you to talk about kind of what your outlook is for the future.
Okay. You know, a real quick, just kind of general, that, you know, as most people know, we are the incarceration capital of the world. We lock up more people than anybody else, actually twice the national average almost, which is not a good thing. And our crime rates are still in the top 10 in just about every category. So we, you know, for me, that's real simple. You know, what we're doing is not working, and we need to look at what we're doing and make some changes. The other thing is that we lock up nonviolent offenders at 1.5 to 3 times the national average. So again, something that we need to work on, on the front end of. You know, we have 36,000 offenders that are in prison, and look, We've experienced success already. We down 5,000 inmates in the last 3.5 years. We're down 5,000 because of what we invested in reentry centers, day reporting centers, and transition specialists at the local level. And I say local level. That makes us unique with other states. We house half of that 36,000, actually more than half, at the local level at $24.39 a day. Mm. And unfortunately, 80% of those are discharging out of those parish jails. So we know that's where we need to look at and making some changes and bringing that up to the level of state prisons. And that is unique, as far as I'm aware of. No other state has that percentage of population discharging back to their communities without any transition whatsoever. So that's a unique challenge. You know, what we looked at in the task force, which we started meeting last June, of course, we looked at, you know, focusing our beds on serious offenders rather than nonviolent offenders, as was just mentioning. Community corrections, our probation and pro division, is in our department. We have 70,000 people that are on probation and parole. And actually 59% of our intake comes from revocations through probation and parole. Obviously an area we need to look at and reinvest in and do some things that differently to avoid 59% of revocations coming into our prison system. And of course, clearing away barriers to reentry, just what you just mentioned about having that label of being an ex-offender, an ex-con. You know, it's hard enough now to make it without that label. But with that label, you know, we need our business groups to understand these people are, you know, if we recommend them for parole or they go through the parole process, 90% of the chances are they've changed and they deserve an opportunity. And look, it's not going to be 100%, but we feel like we can do a pretty good job while we have them, making them a better person. So clearing away barriers is important. We looked at fines and fees when, you know, when guys come into us between driver's license, fines and fees, when they discharge, they have a bill that they can't afford to pay. So you try to put them to work, and we experienced that in our transitional work programs. And when they start working, they look at their first check and it's 50 cents because they've taken everything they've earned for fines, fees, child support, whatever the case might be. And right. That they're going back to the corner. They are going back to do what they did originally because they're not making enough money to make their household work, you know? Sure. So you have that to do. And then of course, to me, the most strategic and critical part of this whole deal is the reinvestment side. Our projections are, and we work with Pew. We worked a year with Pew, and that was a great organization, did the most historical data mining in our state's history over the last year to see what we needed to look at and what things we could do a little differently. And the reinvestment part of this is we're going to save roughly $280 million over the next 10 years, and $186 million of that will be reinvested back into the criminal justice system. So that's the critical point. We're in the process right now of developing a plan, a five-year plan. In 5 years, we're going to have roughly $90 million more than we have today to be in our criminal justice system. So where do we want to put that money? And that's what we're looking at. Some of the things I just mentioned are areas that we need to reinvest in. And let me say this about the business community here in Louisiana. They've jumped on board here with us on this reinvestment side and on the understanding that we need to do things differently in Louisiana. They lobbied for us in getting out 10 bills through the session. They were right there with us supporting it in committee on the House floor and Senate floor. And so we have business and industry understanding what you just said, that we have got to give these people another opportunity when they leave our prison system. And, you know, one of the things that comes to mind, this is a little story that when we opened up what we call a workforce development transitional work program in a little north of Lake Charles, West Louisiana here, where we have a humongous industrial growth construction going on. And I got approached from the economic development community in Lake Charles to say, and this was Phelps that I just talked about with clothes, was sitting there vacant. They said, we want to lease that facility to put immigrant workers into that facility to work in Lake Charles. And wow, immigrant workers, why don't we hire some of our own? You know, let's look at. So what ended up happening is now we have 300 beds there that are working in a transitional work program where offenders go out and work in the industry and actually make wages comparable to who they're working next to. And then they come back to that facility in the evening time. And we have roughly 3,500 beds or so like that throughout the state. And you can talk to any business that employs these people that is successful and it works. So, you know, business leaders across the country have to join in with us and help. And I mean, you know, our country locks up a lot of people and a lot of people discharging every day in this country that deserve an opportunity. And I'm a firm believer in that. And I'll go to my retirement bed knowing that that's what we need to do. And I've seen it, you know, I've seen it happen and it works.
Well, you've earned the reputation too among your business community. And again, I can only tell you, from so many of the side conversations that were taking place among the wardens, how impressed they were with the progress you've made and what you've done. And the interesting part of this as well is when you look at a number of surveys that are taken today with CEOs, small business owners, who basically complain that one of the most difficult challenges they have is to be able to get the right person to fill an open position. And I think that when we dismiss entire populations from that consideration set, we only hurt ourselves. And I think when you've got some of the quality individuals that you have, you know, reentering society who really have a lot to contribute, I think the more the people think about that, you know, in a positive light, the better. You know, you mentioned that it's not 100%. I don't know anybody who hires anyone, it's never 100%. Right. So, you know, it's just never 100% with anyone. But I think, you know, what you're doing is so extraordinary. And if I'm recall correctly, too, in the out of the automotive program, which is one of the programs we visited Angola, actually the graduates, if you will, of that program, that when they get out are, you know, considered very desirable candidates when you consider where else, not only from the standpoint of who they are, but the technical training they receive is also impressive. And if I'm not mistaken too, Perry, I think they were doing some work on your daughter's car, if I'm not, when I was there, which was great. Because I'm thinking, all right, well, there's a pretty high level of trust when you think about that. So that's certainly...
Yeah, kind of puts a little pressure on them too, you know. Oh, yeah. They're a warden. They got his daughter's hands in their life. So, yeah, they were doing her brakes that day, I believe. And
exactly.
But it does show a level of trust. You know, if I'm going to put my daughter goes to school about 3 hours away from here, nursing school, and, you know, if I'm going to put her on the road with a new brake job, I'm going to put in someone's hands I trust. And I do. I trust them. I see the training they get. I see the work they do. And it's up there with anybody's. You know, we do ASC certifications in our automotive shop. It's automotive service excellence. You go in any shop in the country in a dealership, and most of them have that sign on the wall. It says ASC certified mechanics. That's the industry standard, you know, and that's what our guys are. We've probably put out more ASC certifications out of our shops than the rest of the state of Louisiana combined in the last, you know, 5 years or so. And so these guys are coming out with real skills. They're employable.
Well, no question. And the peer-to-peer culture that you have within that prison really does so much to lift everyone up. You know, before we you know, wrap up today, is there anything that you would like to talk about that we haven't touched on with regard to some of the work you're doing either at Angola or throughout the state of Louisiana?
Well, you know, from my standpoint, I hit on it lightly with the local level challenge that we have in Louisiana. And, you know, as I mentioned, we opened up 8-9 reentry centers that we didn't have before and have invested roughly $8 million. And we're saving right now on that $5,000 a year, $44 million a year. So, you know, my concentration is on community corrections and what we're doing at the local level for our prisoners and helping them rebound back into our communities. And you know, reentry court, we have to expand on that. We have to provide additional slots, if you will. And Perry just sent me an email here in the last couple of days. We need to start planning on, he and I have been talking about how can we expand this at Angola and at other institutions to make it available, because legislation was passed this past session to allow every district court to participate in reentry. However, they have to come to us first and make sure we have the resources to do it. So, you know, that can certainly help us. And finding the judges, and that's a key component here, finding judges, that because this is extra work for judges at that level too, and getting them on board and making sure they understand what our best practices are, what it takes to be a judge, as a reentry court judge. It's not, you know, it's nice at the end to have a little graduation and it's all fun and dandy when they get back. But there's a lot of work to it for them.
It's an investment for sure.
It is. So, and then the other thing is our probation and parole division. I just to let everybody know that, and that we have our caseload is 140 and it should be 100. And of course, the day reporting centers, we need to expand on that and continue to improve on that area. But I appreciate y'all giving us the opportunity to talk a little bit about Louisiana and what we've been able to do and what we are working on and going to work on. I'll know a lot more about the reinvestment side and understanding that we have a piece of legislation that protects that funding. And that was a real challenge for the DAs and the sheriffs, because they've been through this with our juvenile sector. And we are investing, and that's another thing that people need to understand. We're investing 20% of our savings in the Office of Juvenile Justice. So, because there's a tunnel there, right into adult corrections, unfortunately, and we need to cut that supply line off, and we need to invest money into our juvenile sector too, and reemphasize how proud I was of the business industry getting involved in this, and just what you just said a while ago, in that it helps everybody if we get these people on their feet. They become taxpayers rather than tax burdens, and that's important for everybody to understand.
Well, I just want to really thank you both for your leadership on this whole issue. Like I said, I think my visit to that Warden Exchange program meeting and subsequent visit to Angola Prison were among the most impressive things I've ever seen, and was so, very pleased to be exposed to that, exposed to the good work you're doing, and also to hope that you continue the leadership role you have with the Warden Exchange Program, because there's so many great things you're doing in Louisiana that if we can do them across the rest of this country and be, you know, as successful elsewhere as you've been there and as you continue to grow the program, it's only going to help a lot of lives. So just appreciate all of that. I want to thank you both for being on the program today, and we'll be watching for all the continued good work you do.
Thank you very
thank
much.
You very much. Appreciate
thank
it.
You bet. Thank you.
All right.
Thanks for joining us today. To learn more about Peer Advantage, to submit questions to Leo and our guest, and to subscribe to the Year of the Peer podcast, please visit us at leobottari.com. That's LEOBOTTARY.com. This podcast is produced by me, Randy Cantrell. Hosted, of course, by Leo Bottari. Music provided by Kevin McLeod, Vibe Ace. Licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0 license.